Long before reality TV and programs like American Idol and Dancing with the Stars, millions of Americans turn their ears and their imaginations each week to the radio. Programs like The Shadow, Gunsmoke, and Lux Radio Theater were pretty popular in the 1930s through the 1950s, and even today they have their fans. A few hundred of those fans gathered in Newark, New Jersey this weekend to keep the art of radio drama alive. But as Scott Gurian reports, this gathering will be their last.
Elaine Hyman started acting from the age of 11 on a variety of radio programs like The Green Hornet and The Lone Ranger.
No, Sally. We're not outlaws. You needn't be frightened.
Oh, I'm not frightened. Why do you wear that mask, mister?
Now 77, Hyman says she gets nostalgic listening back to herself on these old broadcasts.
It was the kind of pure radio and pure Americana. Cowboys said things like shan't. And it was a very innocent time, and the shows were very innocent. I mean, the bad guys always got caught, and they weren't that bad, and the good guys triumphed.
For Robert Flood and several other convention goers who were blind or visually impaired, old-time radio programs served as a theater of the imagination.
It was actually my mother who noticed that I was not focusing too well on my sight, so she introduced me to a radio program, The Lone Ranger. And when I was a little kid, I remember turning my chair around, and as Fred Foy would announce the Lone Ranger, I'd be riding with him visually in my head, because when you don't see with your eyes, you see with your mind.
The golden age of radio came to an end when CBS broadcast the last of its radio dramas in September 1962. And now, more than 50 years later, in an era of television, video games, and changing tastes, convention organizers say that radio drama just doesn't have the audience it used to. Many of the old-time radio actors are also dying out. So after 36 years, the group Friends of Old-Time Radio announced that this will be its last ever convention. It's not all bad news, though. People who want to listen back to episodes of Sherlock Holmes or Abbott and Costello now have more chances than ever via satellite radio and the internet. For NPR News, I'm Scott Gurian.
This is NPR News. If you watch cooking shows like Top Chef on TV, then you may have heard of sous vide. It's a technique that involves slow cooking food in vacuum-sealed plastic bags to preserve the juices and prevent overcooking. Sous vide was once the province of restaurant chefs and home cooks willing to shell out hundreds for fancy water ovens. Now, do-it-yourselfers are cooking sous vide with their own inexpensive rigs. John Kalish reports.
People who cook at home with sous vide setups tend to rave about their steaks.
I do not buy steaks at restaurants anymore because we can make them much better this way.
And their fish.
Once you've cooked a perfect piece of salmon, you'll never want to eat salmon at a restaurant anymore because it's always going to be overcooked. Unless they're doing sous vide, of course.
You can also cook fruit and vegetables in a sous vide cooker. This woman was in ecstasy after trying pears that had been poached for 16 hours.
It slides across your mouth like a spoonful of custard. It's such a bright flavor. It's like a bright summer day. It's eating summer.
That's Lisa Chu. She and her physicist fiancé make an $80 kit that attaches to cheap kitchen appliances, such as coffee makers or crock pots, and turns them into sous vide cookers. When their Ember kit is assembled, it consists of a small box with a digital display. Chu was cooking eggs at a gathering of DIYers called Maker Faire in New York. She was using a small, inexpensive deep fryer filled with water. Devotees of sous vide cooking often gush about eggs cooked this way.
Look at that. The whites are still runny, and I just peel them back and reveal the custardy yolk, which is like unnaturally delicious. Oh, baby.
Chu's kit for hacking kitchen appliances has 23 pages of instructions, so it's not for the electronically inept. It took Matt McNamara, an investment manager in Manhattan, an hour and a half to put his sous vide kit together. He connected his to a $20 coffee urn.
I had very simple criterion. Heating element holds water.
The night I dropped by, McNamara was getting ready to cook 2-inch-thick strip steaks. Each was placed in a special Ziploc bag that had a valve for pumping the air out.
The first time I tried chicken, I was very conservative, but I also had it turned up too high. And it just came out kind of like a softball. So it was just, you know, solid, bunched-up chicken breast protein.
The long cooking times, 48 hours is not uncommon, require precise control of the temperature. Eric Wilhelm runs the DIY website Instructables.com. He posted a recipe for beef ribs that are in a sous vide cooker for 2 days at 135 degrees. But even after all those hours in the so-called meat jacuzzi, the ribs still need to be finished.
One of the things that doesn't happen when you cook stuff sous vide is you don't get browning reactions on the outside of the meat. You don't get that good, it's done smell because the temperature doesn't go high enough. And so what you do is once you've cooked something sous vide, you often finish it like on a grill or in a very hot skillet or with a blowtorch.
With a PhD in mechanical engineering, Wilhelm is no slouch as a DIYer, but he nevertheless opted to purchase a $120 temperature controller to connect to the large rice cooker that is part of his home sous vide setup. There's a lot more DIY in Dustin Andrews' sous vide cooking system. A software engineer and self-described maker in Duval, Washington, Andrews fills a styrofoam beer cooler with water and heats it with a submersible aquarium heater he hacked for the job. And instead of buying a temperature controller, Andrews wrote some code and soldered some microchips to a circuit board to make his own.
Why would I buy something when I could spend twice as much money on electronic components and then spend 2 weekends building one?
For those interested in sous vide cooking at home but not inclined to go the DIY route, small ones can now be found online for $300. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Remember this commercial from back in the 1980s?
A Milky Way day helps you work, rest, and play.
Work, rest, and play. Well, Martin Lindstrom has worked in advertising for much of his life, helping corporations come up with new and, yes, deceptive ways for them to help sell you products. And he's written a kind of tell-all about how the industry works. The book is called Brandwashed: Tricks Companies Use to Manipulate Our Minds and Persuade Us to Buy. And according to Lindstrom, the best marketers know that the average American three-year-old can recognize at least 100 brands. But that's not all.
We even are affected by brand messages before we're born, while we're still in the womb.
How is that possible?
Well, a recent research study conducted in the UK shows that pregnant women, while they're watching a certain TV show, in fact were affecting the unborn babies. And as they were born later on, they had a strong preference for this show, where in comparison to the group which were not watching this show while the mother was pregnant, they had no effect whatsoever.
You write that the tiniest things also can make a difference in our perception of a brand, even the sound of the packaging.
Yeah, that's right. We know, for example, today that if you open a cola, the sound generated, in fact, is so powerful that it generates at an unconscious level craving. And that craving actually is so important because most people are not watching TV commercials anymore. They're listening to the commercials while they're standing in the kitchen or whatever they're doing. Because it is non-conscious, it actually affects our craving instinct. So what we noticed in this research was that a lot of brands have forgotten to put in the craving sound and now putting it in. And not just the sound of a cola being opened or ice cubes in a glass, but also the sound of a sizzling steak, for example, is so hardwired into our behavior that in the end of the day, we simply can't stand back. We actually have to be part of that product.
You recently wrote an article, and it's also in the book, about Whole Foods. And you talk about how they make their produce more attractive.
Yes. So as you enter the Whole Foods store, you will notice in many of their stores they are cutting fresh flowers.
Oh, right. That's right.
And it's not a coincidence. First of all, most likely they're not earning money on it. But what they are doing is to tell you at an unconscious level that, in fact, everything is fresh in this store. Just take the opposite. Imagine you're walking into the store and it had cans of tuna with the expiration dates of 2 years. You will immediately, at the center of the entire store, would be 2 year plus old. And as you will notice in Whole Foods in particular, they're playing a lot on the farmer's feel. You feel
yes.
things come from the farmer's market.
Right.
Now, if you are very careful, you look at those boxes which are holding the apples and the bananas. And yes, they're coming from something called Patty's Farm, making us believe that Patty was just backing up her truck this morning and
right.
offloading all her bananas from the farm. Well, the story is probably very different. Those individual cardboard boxes is actually one big gigantic dummy with plastic inside, which are holding the bananas. And yes, in the backside of the store, they're offloading all those bananas from huge plastic containers, most likely flown in the day before, into those individual-looking cardboard boxes, which, by the way, is not Patty's Farm. It's actually been designed by a graphic design company in New York City to make us feel this is nostalgia at its peak.
I'm speaking with Martin Lindstrom. He's the author of a new book called Brandwashed. Martin, you actually carried out your own experiment. You hired a family to live in Laguna Beach in Southern California. You filmed them secretly, and you had them basically invite friends over from the neighborhood, and they would just casually talk about things, brands of things that they're using, like a blender or a type of car. Tell me about this experiment.
So what we did then was non-scripted, basically to ask this family to have one mission, to tell the world about 10 different brands we carefully had selected, but to make sure no one would discover why they were talking about those brands, mm-hmm. so the hidden intent. I have to admit, I was fairly skeptical in the beginning. I thought, I wonder what we'll get out of this, but was blown away already the first week when I realized that the word of mouth is so much more powerful. And the reason why I had that sense was because I had actually tried almost a year before exactly that phenomenon on my own body. I was standing at a gas station in Australia, in Sydney, and this man comes up to me as I'm filling up my car and saying, "Hey, mate, would you like to try this type of gas?" And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, I actually have the same car as you have, and it just works so much better. I would try that if I was you." And I was not listening so much to it, but what I realized was that 2 weeks later, I actually was using that brand he was recommending, and I heard exactly that same voice. 3 months later, it was at another gas station, and that man was now not talking to me, but to another person next to him, saying exactly the same phrase, "I have the same car as you, and you should use this." And I realized this was a setup, and he was employed by this oil company in order to promote this particular brand.
Hmm.
And I realized, hey, if I can fall for this, working in the industry of marketing and branding, then everyone would be falling for this. So coming back to the experiment, this simple family, they within 3 months were able to spread the word of mouth to 15,000 people
Incredible.
Across California.
The family were, are the Morgansons. And I just want to play a clip of tape. This is a Gina Morganson, the mother, talking about Kiss My Face lotion to some friends that are just casually visiting. And she brings this up. Let's take a listen.
I use, you know, the Kiss My Face stuff I was telling you guys about, all that peace soap and all that great soap. Well, yeah. I use all that stuff for my face now.
They have a whole facial line too?
Unbelievable.
Oh, I thought it was just kind of the basic. Yeah,
the smells are like you've been at a spa.
So here's the thing, that is so creepy. And I think it's creepy because we have all been in that situation. But this was being done deliberately. How effective was it?
Well, it was so effectful that we know that every person which was affected by or listened into these conversations, they bought a brand. In fact, we know that 9 out of 10 definitely bought at least 1 out of the 10 brands.
Wow.
It just gave me an indication of how powerful this was. And I was pretty convinced that after 1 month, people will start to realize, hey, this is a setup.
Yeah, I mean, weren't people in the neighborhood saying, this is a little weird. This family keeps talking about all these brands every time we go to their house.
No, and do you know why? Because you and I are talking about brands 25% of our entire time. Huh. And not only that, when we are sitting at the dinner table, we are talking about brands 51% of the time. So it's become such a big part of our lives that I would almost claim we have nothing to say to each other if we can't talk about brands.
How do we protect ourselves? Do we have any, is there any hope?
Well, besides you switching off the television, the computer and the iPhone and going under your duvet and just sleeping for the rest of your life, there is a couple of other pieces of advice which probably is more useful. Point number one, you need to educate your children at home. They do not know what brands are, really. They think brands is some physical stuff. But the reality is it's in our mind. And if you start to educate them about that, at a very young age, like 5 or 6 years old, they're prepared before they're going to school. So they're not, you know, a victim to this peer pressure we're seeing happening so much right now. Secondly, when you're going out shopping, there's some very simple tricks you can use. One of them is never to grab a shopping cart. Why? Well, because we know today that if I'm doubling the size of your shopping cart, you actually are buying up to 40% more. Another thing you should do is to always pay cash, because then we have a physical relationship with the money. Make sure you're never hungry. It's pretty natural. But by the way, you're also buying more clothes and more CDs and whatever if you're hungry. So there's a lot of concrete advice. But I think in the end of the day, what you have to be aware of is that this is our life and we should just not be fooled that it's not there. So that's the reason why I'm writing Brandwashed, because I think people need a wake-up call.
That's Martin Lindstrom. He's the author of the new book, Brandwashed: Tricks Companies Use to Manipulate Our Minds and Persuade Us to Buy. Martin Lindstrom, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
To Japan now, where a food company engineer just accomplished an amazing feat again. And who knows, maybe next year he'll do it again. That's because Shigeru Kondo last week calculated the never-ending mathematical constant pi to 10 trillion digits. That doubles the previous world record held by Shigeru Kondo. Kondo did it all on a 48 terabyte computer he built in his own home. The computer began working on the problem a year ago. 2 months in, a hard drive failure. Back to square one. But from then on, the machine faithfully churned out numbers all the way to the 10 trillion digit finish line, even through Japan's monstrous earthquake. Kondo's wife complained about the electric bill, nearly $400 a month, even though the 104-degree temperature in the computer room made it a great place to dry laundry. The computer occasionally overloads the fuse box, but Kondo is always ready with a backup power source, because you have to be prepared for the unexpected when you calculate an unending number.
From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. Europe's leaders met again today in Brussels to try and prevent a potential financial collapse. There are echoes of the banking crisis here in the U.S., which came about after banks lent money to fuel an unsustainable housing boom. Well, in Europe, it's slightly different. Banks lent money to European countries like Greece, countries that are now unable to pay back those loans. And many in Europe don't want to bail out those banks or those countries. Default, of course, could have serious consequences on Wall Street. Our cover story today, as European markets get closer to possible meltdown, has anything changed on Wall Street since 2008? In a moment, we'll hear from the sheriff of Wall Street, Elliot Spitzer, but first to NPR's Eric Westerveld, who is in Brussels. And Eric, talk to me for a moment about what is at stake right now in Europe.
Good evening, Guy. Yes, another weekend, another failed EU summit about the Eurozone. I mean, European leaders really, as expected, postpone the big decisions until later in the week. And here are some of the big major issues they hope to come to an agreement on by this Wednesday. The biggest one by far is really how to best use and leverage the power of the Eurozone's rescue fund, how to get the most out of this 440 billion euro fund. So if the debt contagion spreads to bigger European economies such as Italy and Spain, European countries will in theory be ready. We've already seen during this debt debacle, you know, an ineffectual bailout of Greece, at least so far it's been ineffectual, as well as bailouts of Portugal and Ireland that have, by all accounts, worked a little better to shore up those two economies. But the fear is, Guy, that the cost of borrowing will become too high for these much larger economies of Italy and Spain. Major European banks then could be undermined. And what started as a Greek debt problem, you know, quickly mushrooms into another global financial crisis.
Well, what are the potential consequences if European leaders don't get this right, both for Europe and for the U.S.?
The stakes are very high, certainly because the financial system is, of course, so interconnected. And a deeper European debt and banking crisis, you know, would have a huge ripple effect and could further undermine America's still fragile economic state and would certainly reverberate across global markets even more. On the political, social level, Guy, I think the debt crisis, you know, has already deeply shaken Europe. It has continually rattled the markets. It's prompted unprecedented and very painful austerity measures and budget cuts in Greece and in other countries. It sparked street protests and riots in Athens, as well as demonstrations in many European capitals. You know, ordinary citizens across the continent are worried about the debt problem triggering a deep recession on the heels of the 2008 financial crisis. Taxpayers and protesters are saying, you know, don't use our money to bail out banks. They made bad investments. They should shoulder the losses themselves. Germans are angry, saying, you know, Greece lied about its finances to get into the Eurozone. Why should we prop them up? So I have to say the euro, which was supposed to help unite Europe, is now during this debt mess really starting to pull Europe farther apart. And the pressure really is on politicians, you know, to get it right this coming week and finally propose, you know, a much promised comprehensive strategy to tackle the debt mess.
That's NPR's Eric Westervelt in Brussels. Eric, thanks.
Thank you, Guy.
It's been 3 years since the banking crisis here sent Wall Street into a tailspin, and more than a year since the Dodd-Frank financial reforms were passed by Congress. This past week, the Dow reached a three-month high, and despite high unemployment across the country, Jesse Eisinger, who covers finance for ProPublica, says many people on Wall Street are still making big money.
The top four banks are still extremely profitable. Wells Fargo, Citigroup, JP Morgan, Bank of America, those are very highly profitable banks. The concern of investors is that the asset quality isn't good and that they're going to take losses on the assets that they have. Loans that they've made in the past are going to go bad. But right now, the new loans look profitable on first blush initially because the yield curve is relatively steep.
Why do you think it is that there seems to be a huge gap, a disconnect between the majority of Americans and those who work on Wall Street in the sense of trust? There's this idea that the people who work on Wall Street know how to game the system and that the rest of us can't really be part of that. I mean, is that the sense you get?
Absolutely. Over the last 20 years, we've had a process where the economy has become increasingly financialized. So a greater proportion of the economy is financial services. And it's almost become a sort of closed system, a self-fulfilling system where finance companies finance other finance companies, and there's an enormous amount of speculation in this ecosystem that creates a lot of profits without any societal benefit from more efficient financial markets and capital markets. We don't see companies more easily raising money to go out and make goods and services that people really want. And that leads to a deep problem. And then the other obvious problem is that these guys blew up the world in 2008. So they got all this money, all these profits, all these huge bonuses, and then brought us into a global recession. And then we had to, as taxpayers, bail them out, and we haven't gotten the good economy that we thought we paid for when we bailed these banks out.
After the financial collapse in 2008, we started to learn about all these shenanigans, default swaps and derivatives and the ways that bankers were able to make money. Given the reforms introduced by Dodd-Frank, is Wall Street as a whole, are people on Wall Street now behaving better?
There is an ascendancy of the people who are a little bit more cautious. The problem is that's largely going to be a temporary phenomenon unless there's some serious structural change. And we got almost no serious structural change in Dodd-Frank. What we got instead was trying to strengthen the regulators' hands. But really, regulators are still susceptible to being lobbied by banks and their expensive lawyers. And they didn't have any structural change to their business. So we didn't break up the banks. We didn't make them smaller. We just asked them to change their behavior. And that works maybe for a couple of years after a crisis because everybody remembers it. It's fresh in their minds. But that won't work over the long term.
Jesse Eisinger is a senior reporter at ProPublica. He won a Pulitzer Prize this year for his coverage of Wall Street. Jesse Eisinger, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This past week, Goldman Sachs announced a quarterly loss. It's just the second time since 1999 that the company's posted a loss, and yet Goldman has still set aside more than $10 billion for year-end bonuses. And former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer says that shows just how little things have changed on Wall Street since the crisis of 2008.
Well, see, that's the thing people need to understand. The fact that there was a loss there on paper should not be interpreted by people as meaning suddenly the executives and shareholders of Goldman Sachs and the partners of Goldman are not going to be getting their enormous salaries. They still are getting very, very outsized compensation.
Okay, Eliot Spitzer, many ordinary people, as you know, who don't work on Wall Street have lost so much trust in our financial institutions that they are unwilling to invest in the stock market today. There's this idea that somehow the system is rigged.
I think that small investors do not get a fair shake. Small investors are sold stuff that they should not be sold, while the insiders are given advantages both in terms of information, access to stocks, access to IPOs, access to all of the games that can be played. Most recently, the settlement by Citibank, they paid $285 million. Sounds like a big sum of money, but it's not in the context of Citibank's profit last quarter, I think, of $2.8 billion. Because they had sold a product to the public and then bet against it. They had designed it to fail. Now, how can you do that? How can any self-respecting person in business do that? Now, that is not, I'm saying that is always what happens, but I spent many years as Attorney General trying to root out the inherent conflicts of interest that exist between the interests of many of the people at Goldman and Citi and Bank of America who put together these products, who may have one thing in mind that may not be the best interests of the individual who has sold that product.
Let's move on to the Occupy Wall Street movement. You have written recently in Slate that this has shaken up American politics. How so?
The defining issue in the political arena over the last year had been almost exclusively, how do we cut the debt? Issues of equity, issues of jobs, issues of growth had fallen off the agenda. And somehow what the Occupy Wall Street folks have done is re-inject the issue of equity into our discussion, and that is critically important because we are distributing wealth in a way that is long-term corrosive, and more importantly, we're generating the wealth in a way that may not be good for the country in the long run. The Occupy Wall Street folks are the ones who I think have to be given a fair bit of credit for putting it back on the agenda.
Couldn't you make the case, though, that Wall Street is an easy target? As a former governor of New York, you know that Wall Street, their argument is they account for 14% of all tax revenues in New York State.
Look, Wall Street is an easy target, and that doesn't mean that's why they're the target. And when I was Attorney General and began to make cases with respect to highly improper practices on Wall Street, it wasn't popular to do it. I thought it was necessary. So, yes, they're an easy target at times because they've made themselves an easy target, and I don't say that to sort of paint with too broad a brush, but structurally we've got a significant problem, and that's why putting structural reforms in place to deal with not only equity issues but growth issues is critically important.
Is there still, in your view, fraud happening on Wall Street?
The answer is inevitably yes, and I don't say that, again, to sweep with too, paint with too broad a brush. There are going to be some examples of it. The question is there a structural crisis the way there was 2 or 3 years ago? And I think we have made some real progress, but not nearly enough. In other words, Dodd-Frank doesn't get rid of the issue of too big to fail. We still have major institutions that are, in fact, more concentrated now than they used to be. Have we made some progress? Sure. Enough? Not even close.
That's Eliot Spitzer, former governor of New York. Eliot Spitzer, thank you so much.
My pleasure.